Welcome. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome to another one of our incredible episodes of Theater Baltimore, once again with my dear friend Kwame Kwayama, who is Artistic Director of Center Stage, Director of the new play there, Dance of the Holy Ghosts, joining us here from New York as he's in New York directing Much Ado About Nothing for the mobile unit of the Public Theater, and he's with us now. Kwame, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Brother Mark. As always, man, as always, it's great to have your support, and I look forward to our chat.
You're just capturing America by artistic storm, going all over the country, directing plays here and there.
Well, brother, you know, the truth, Mark, is that, you know, I have to count my blessings. And one of the things that I said when I came to Center Stage is that I wanted to make sure that you know, that our reputation nationally increased. You know, in the last week, we've had the PBS special about the Raising Cycle go live across the nation. And part of it is also about me directing at other major theaters like the Public Theater in New York, like Oregon Shakespeare, and then having them come and play with us. So, you know, it's a win-win.
So let's talk about this production. I'm Marcus Gardley. I will say that I've heard the name. This is the first time I've seen or read one of his productions. So in that sense, he's new to me. Talk to us a bit about this young playwright, who he is and how you found him in this play.
It's always difficult to talk about playwrights or even the first time you encountered them. But actually, Marcus is quite different. I was in New York on a scholarship, and a friend of mine ran to me and said, "Have you heard of a writer called Marcus Gardley? He's just graduating, and I'm doing a reading of his play, Dance of the Holy Ghost." So she sent me that, and I instantly fell in love with it. And it was an earlier iteration of it. Marcus is one of those writers that it's very easy to say there are many of us who have been inspired by August Wilson. I call him son of August. And that he's one of the few that actually, that you can see the direct links, not in the way that he's imitating, but in the way that the poetry drives the drama, in the way that the poetic exploration of the experience of the African-American in all its glory, from academia to family, is right in the DNA of his work. And so, you know, I as a writer myself, I don't write out of that sensibility, which means that I enjoy diving in and dancing with writers who are able to do the things that I cannot. And Marcus is one of those writers.
And this particular play, Dance of the Holy Ghosts, this clearly came from, well, I think all of his plays, now that I begin to look at them, come from his heart and soul, but this one really does. I mean, there's something about, this is not one of his newest plays.
No.
He wrote this like 12 years ago or so, right? So so why this one?
Well, one is, very interestingly, as soon as I arrived in Baltimore, Marcus requested to meet me at Playwrights Horizon in Minneapolis, where they were putting on a reading of this play. And he said, and they asked him, which director in the country would you most like to come and talk to? And he chose me. So, of course, you know, being chosen, my ego said yes. And I went over. And I fell in love with the play. I fell in love with the new work that he had done on the play. But I, most importantly, I fell in love with the way that he was trying to give honor to pain. His grandfather, and he'll probably tell you this himself, but, you know, this play is based on letters that the family found written from his grandfather to his grandmother. They were estranged for 20 years, but yet he would write her every week saying, "I love you, will you come back to me?" And this play is born out of that sensibility, out of the sensibility of an artist who didn't know how to give adequate attention to his family, who didn't know how to give adequate attention to his wife, even though his wife was the source of his brilliance and the source of his art. And so it's a beautiful story of both an artist and the choices that artists make, but also of a father and of a husband and of a grandfather. And the effects of choosing incorrectly or even loving too much what effects that has, not just on the first generation, but the generations that follow.
And talk about a bit about your choosing, your casting of this, and also the way you chose to direct it, both in terms of the set you designed and in terms of the style in which you had these characters portray these parts.
Well, it's, as you know, the play is called Dance of the Holy Ghost, A Play on Memory, is the full title.
Right.
And that really was my way into this play. It's beautifully designed by Neil Patel, who does a lot of my work. And the idea is, as he recalls these stories or these moments in his life, I wanted to aesthetically make them as smooth as possible. I mean, it's written in an almost filmic style, that one moment he's in today, in the present, the next minute he's in 1957, and then at the turn of a hat or the turn of a head, he's in 1975 or the 1980s. So it jumps through three or four different time periods. My job directorially was to make those periods very clear, but also to make it as smooth as possible, but also as haunting and ghost-like as possible. And I have to say, I'm very pleased with this production, with the beautiful lights by Michelle Houellebecq and the sound by Milbo and Co. I mean, what we've tried to do is make something that is haunting, but yet beautiful to look at and smooth. And I think that serves the narrative well.
And the characters themselves, obviously, are playing, the actors are playing these characters at different stages of their lives. And some alive and some dead, and playing them as ghosts.
Yes. I mean, Oscar he is just a magnificent actor, Michael Genet.
Yes.
Who sings and acts and plays this lead character from 72 down to 16. And Denise Burse, the wonderful, wonderful actor, who, of course, is one of the stars of Tyler Perry's, sitcoms, is she plays this woman from 16, and even when she's dead. And I mean, the virtuosity of these actors, I tell you, Mark, it was such a joy. It was hard, because being convincing at 72 and being convincing at 16 is a very hard stretch. But we managed in the rehearsal period to really invest in truth. How do we tell the truth? I don't need the audience to look at them and say, you're 16 and a day. I just need you to look at them and go, this was at the very beginning of their story. This was in the middle of their story, and this is at the end of their story. And all of the actors, they jump around playing these different age groups and in these different periods with deftness, I would say.
I mean, because they're both, I mean, just around them, the set and the costume design was intense but minimalist.
Yes. It's very hard to jump through time periods and to change costumes like 15 times. And again, the wonderful thing about this play, the wonderful thing about theater, is that it exists terribly well in the abstract. All one needs to do is put on a cap, and that says, I'm now 5 years older. All one needs to do is put on a gown, and it says, I'm now 20 years older. All one needs to do is slouch their body in a certain way, and now I'm 40 years older. And so rehearsal was about making sure that we found those nuances. But the design choices were also about making sure that it was minimal, but yet very significant.
So, one of the things that I think you're bringing to Baltimore in a much deeper way. I mean, you have a very broad, wide spectrum of plays that you're presenting this season and last season that are very different, that really from comedy to serious drama. But in the process of doing that, you are bringing to the fore these new young black playwrights.
Yes.
That many people in Baltimore and in this area have never heard of, never seen, never experienced, never felt, and you're not blocking them into February.
Absolutely. I would say this, Mark, that I think part of my job as an artistic director is to give our audience sometimes what we think they want, and then to introduce our audience to something new. and then to take him on another journey. The thing about introducing new African-American playwrights to our subscribers into Baltimore is partly comes from, I'm a great fan of August Wilson, as I've said many times. Right. And Baltimore has done maybe 8 out of the 10 of his cycle. So I think my job, and that's what Irene did, and I think my job is now to introduce our audiences to the new August Wilson. There will never be another singular August Wilson, but the children of the most interesting playwrights across the country who are investigating the themes that August investigated, but in their fashion, in their own style. And that is part of my raison d'etre.
And I would be remiss. There's one actor in this piece I really want to talk about as well, who I think does an incredible job, a powerful job in this play, Denise Burris, as Viola.
She is just a magnificent actor. Of course, as I think I may have said, she starred in Meet the Paines, Tyler Perry's work, and many people may know her from that.
Oh, you did mention that. I'm sorry, you did mention.
No worries. More than happy to talk about Denise some more. Not only is she a most beautiful human being and aesthetically beautiful, but she was the kind of actor who would play Viola across the ages, and I believe her every single choice. She was also the mother to the company, that she would look after the younger actors. And day two, she came up to me and she said, Kwame, I just want to thank you for introducing me to a new crop of young actors. And we have students in from BSA, as you know, Baltimore School of the Arts.
Right.
And they come in and they sit in rehearsal once a week. And we would have a 20-minute break. And when normally the actors need that time to recoup, and she and Michael would make their way to the young actors, the young performers from BFA, and use their 20 minutes just talking to them about life, about art, about career. She's a magnificent actor, but an even greater human being.
And you did have these young actors, Sheldon Best, Jasmine Carmichael, Chandra Thomas.
Lovely. What a joy they were to work with. In particular, Chandra, she would go over to these young actors. But I tell you, the thing about the company that we've assembled here, and it's one of the strongest companies that I've worked with, is that each and every one of them is worth their weight in gold. During the rehearsal process, and that's the time that I live, you know, mostly with a play, not while it's in performance, but they would be so inventive. They would come in with choices already made, and then I would say, how about this? And then they would just turn it on its head. There is a quality amongst these young actors just coming out of school that is second to none. I'm so excited for American theater, looking in particular at this new young crop of young black actors, both male and female.
This is an amazing play, Dance of the Holy Ghost, a play on memory, by Marcus Gardley, who we'll be talking to in our next segment here. And we're talking to Kwame Kwe Arma, Artistic Director of Center Stage, who directed this incredible play, Dance of the Holy Ghost, a play on memory, that runs through November 17th at Center Stage. And Kwame, good luck in New York, my brother. And
thank you, my brother.
See you on your return.
As always, it's such a pleasure, and I thank you for your support, not just for me, but for all of Baltimore with your work, Mark. And I say it sincerely.
Thank you, brother. Thank you very much. Take care.
Bless you.
Stay tuned. We're going to come back to continue this conversation with Marcus Gardley, the man who wrote this play. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We are going to continue our conversation about Dance of the Holy Ghost, a play on memory. And now we're about to talk to the man who wrote the play, the poet and playwright, Marcus Gardley, who won the 2011 Penn Laura Pels Award for Mid-Career Playwright, author of this play and many others, and joins us here. And Marcus, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
So this, I'm interested in your we've talked a lot about how Kwame kind of put the play together, but in how he put the play together in terms of his direction and casting and why he did it the way he did it. But for you, this play, one of the things that Kwame said to us was, this play in many ways is your story. And he began to tell us, but wanted you to tell us, the story of the letter that you found that inspired you to – these letters, I should say, that you found that inspired you to first write this play.
Absolutely. Well, when my great-grandmother died, after a funeral, we were in her house, you know, putting away some of her belongings, and I came across an old box, and in the box were letters, many, many letters, I would say like 30, 40 letters that my grandfather had wrote to her. Now, my grandfather was dead by this point, and he wrote these love letters, and they had been separated for maybe 30, 40 years. And he was still writing letters to her. I don't know if she ever responded. I can't tell by the letters. It sounded like she actually never responded to him. And so, obviously, it was very moving reading these letters that he had written to her. And they stayed with me. That's the thing that I kept. And maybe like 10 years later after that, I decided to write a play based on the letters.
And that's a big piece of this play, because the two of the main characters in this play... Oscar and Viola. I mean, that's part of what you built this around. This man who's, not that your grandfather did, but spent this time in prison, was a blues singer, and has just made this deal with God, which we'll talk about in a bit, and his relationship with Amelia, the love of his life. It's the same. It's a story. You built from these letters.
Absolutely. I never really knew my grandfather, and so. But the women in my family would talk about him quite often. And I wanted to know, you know, what he was like. And so the play, in a lot of ways, is an experiment or a fiction about what would it be like if he was in my life and helped raise me. And I used the letters as fragments to build his character.
So, I mean, and part of what you write from, I've read this play, I saw the play, I've been reading some of your other plays. A lot of your work, not all of it, but a lot of your work comes out of this black working class experience.
Absolutely.
Of Oakland, California, where you grew up, that is really tinged with lots of Louisiana and Texas.
Absolutely. My mother, her side of the family is from Louisiana. My dad, his side is from Texas. So that major influence on me when I was growing up, actually the street that I lived on, my relatives were my neighbors. So in the culture, I think because we all came from the South, the culture was very much intact. And so, you know, it's a part of who I am. And so, I write about that a lot in my plays.
One of the beauties and power of, like, your plays that I've been reading and I'm just thinking about some other playwrights is because, you know, we want to make the black experience monolithic.
Right.
And it's not. You know,
that's right.
You know, I'm saying, and I just think about growing up Bay Area, coming from Louisiana and Texas, not from North Carolina, Mississippi, or Virginia. I mean, culture is different.
Right. Absolutely. Language is different. The cuisine tends to be different. What people value as, you know, fashion or good dress is different. You know, the way in my place, I really try to even change the poetic style. Person who was born and raised in the South versus someone who might be born and raised in the West Coast. They speak different kind of poetic timber. You know, they express themselves differently. And I think that is one of the most beautiful things about our culture as African-Americans is the diversity within the culture. There's many subcultures within the culture. And, you know, that's one of my goals to express as a playwright.
So, and you, your passion for the written word, you came at it as a poet first and went to San Francisco State, and playwriting was like something because of the way you wrote poetry, you almost kind of stumbled into and said, oh, here I am.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. My professors, you know, I was turning in these massive poems. You know, they were like 3 or 4 or 5 pages poems, and they had stage directions. I think that was a big clue. And so my professors were saying, you know, these sound like plays. These don't sound like just like poems, but they sound like poetic plays. And after about the third or fourth professor, you know, telling you that, you know, I was like, okay, I should take a playwriting class. And, you know, it stuck. By the first couple of hours in the class, I never forget, it was clear that I had found my place, you know. But I always feel like I'm doing both. That's why I always call myself a poet playwright. You know, there's a famous playwright, Lorca, Federico Garcia Lorca. He said he feels like a play is a poem standing up. And so, and I believe in the same thing. I think poetry belongs on stage. You know, I think the people that I admire the most, the people that I see, the voices that I hear all speak in poetic language. So I'm excited about poetry on stage.
That's lovely. I like that. What was that again? A play is a poem standing up. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
He said?
A play is a poem standing up.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny you say that because to me, your writing really feels like the magic realism of certain South American writers, but writ through your voice, writ through the voice of the man you are and the community you come from.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. I mean, the South American magic realism writers are my favorite. And so I'm inspired by them, but I really try to speak through, obviously, the African-American voice and, you know, based upon African-American music. You know, my favorite writer is Toni Morrison.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, she delves in magic realism as well. And so it's my favorite aesthetic. It's my favorite style of writing. And also the kind of literature that I like to read is magical realism. So
it's interesting.
Thank you for that.
No. You can feel it in the work that you do and the words you do and how the characters kind of move between the netherworld of before and after and the reality of the moment they're in and switch around. And that, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, that's being able to kind of touch that amorphous piece, that kind of gray cloud from the mist that isn't the reality of your feet standing on the ground.
Absolutely.
So,
I love that.
So one of the things that was interesting, when I saw the production, these young people there were from London. And and young people in general stood up and applauded, you know. And some older people kind of sat there and went, huh?
Yeah.
You know, but and also applauded. People liked it. But I'm saying that there's something about what you speak to and how you speak to it, I think, which is important in a number of ways because of how theater has become this old people's thing and it can't be that.
Right.
And who you speak to a large body of people generationally. But I'm just saying what I observed in the audience is how the young people reacted to your play.
You know, that's a great, I'm glad you brought that up too, because I'll tell you about two incidents. One, with this play in particular, I really wanted to try to engage. I know a lot of my peers as writers, they really try to speak to young people. They really try to get young people in the theater. They really try to, you know, expand the form and talk about new styles of writing. And I'm definitely a part of that that group as well. But I'm also interested in, like, I'm very much interested and passionate about young people in audiences, young people and older people sitting in the audience together and watching a theater piece and having conversation. And so for me, this play is a symbol of that, because there's the older men, of course, who represents the older generation, and the younger men, my grandfather and me. And their miscommunication to me is also part of my passion of what the theater could be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this miscommunication that eventually at the end becomes communication, becomes a direction in which we can get somewhere together in open dialogue. And I had a reading of this play at the New York Stage and Film maybe 3 years ago in the summer. And it was a diverse audience. It was older people and younger people. And in fact, the older people sat in the front and the older people sat in the back. And at the intermission, the older people, I was like three or four of them, walked down to where the young people were sitting, and they said, we wish you all would stop heckling this play. They said, because we're having a hard time hearing it, and we wish you stop heckling. And the young people said, we're not heckling. It's funny to us. We find it really funny. and the older people said, this is not funny. This is a tragedy. I thought was deep. And they said, you're not supposed to laugh. You guys don't know how to enjoy a piece of theater. So I walked down there and I really tried to have a conversation with both parties about that. Everybody's experience is valid. You know, the young people want to stand up and clap, that's great too. If the older people don't like it or don't want to stand up, that's great too. That it's okay because it's art and we respond to it differently, but can we have a conversation? Can we not be in cliques and different groups and continue, you know, the lack of communication that exists? Because what is the purpose of theater if it can't cause change, if it can't cause positive change in the world? And I think there's just a tradition of theater that older people hold to, that although it's valid, it would be it prevents them from experiencing new forms of theater. And I think the younger generation, what we can be guilty of is too, is not engaging both older forms of theater and also older audiences. So I feel like to say I wish that those dynamics could change.
One of my producers just texted me saying, I found it so funny and sad, your play. So I think that really does hit it. And the other thing you hit on as well is in this particular play that you wrote, that's now at Center Stage, this kind of line between generations in gay and straight. And when the grandfather was pushing the grandson, what was the line? Are you pretty? Are you one of those pretty men?
Yeah.
Right?
Are you funny?
Right. Are you funny? Right. Are you funny? Which is how an old person would say it. Right?
That's right.
Right?
That's right. That's absolutely right.
And it was
it's funny, too, because... Go ahead.
No, go ahead. Go ahead. Go ahead, Marcus.
And, you know, I actually think that... I love the older Jim, the grandfather character, because I think he actually gets the grandson. I think he actually sees who the grandson really is, and he values it. Again, he just doesn't know how to express himself.
Correct.
And I think the young grandson sees the value in his grandfather, but again, it's not to the end where they can really see each other. And they have to. You have to bear all. You have to for the generations to work together. You have to give over something to get something.
I'm curious where you are now as this playwright. I mean, you went to Yale Drama, and Yale Drama School seems to me at this point becoming a real training ground for young playwrights, especially young playwrights of color, which I think is really important in America for this 21st century. So, and that's where you went. Could you talk to that a little bit and where you think it's going in the 21st century and the role that places like Yale Drama play? Because they really are, there's a bunch of you coming out of there.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, the drama school was a great education for me. I had a really great time there, and it really, I would say, is definitely the major start of my career. The most important thing that I gained there was the community of artists that I studied with. We all are very close, and I tend to make a lot of my work with them. And then they do have a really strong tradition of accepting and graduating artists of color. You know, Angela Bassett went there, Courtney Vance, Charles Sutton, Jarrell. You know, a lot of people come out of there. Lynn Nottage.
Angela Bassett.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, Angela Bassett. Jonathan.
Right.
And because of that long tradition, there is a system in place that I think a lot of artists of color can take advantage of. And there's a lot of mentorship that happens. There's a lot of camaraderie. I also never felt like my plays needed to be a certain thing. They really allowed me to express myself. And because of that, I really felt like I was fruitful there as both a student and a writer. And then I think because they attract a lot of really strong playwrights, a lot of well-known playwrights. We formed relationships with them, and so I understood how to work in the business, but also I continued relationships once I graduated. So Lynn has been my mentor since I was a student there. That's 10 years ago. She's still my mentor. And so because of that, there's tools of the trade she gives me, but also there were moments I can tell you honestly that I wanted to quit. And she just really stood by me and encouraged me to keep going at it. And the segue into that, into what's happening with me now, this is a great year for me. I have 10 productions across the country. I'm doing this national tour of this epic play I wrote about Native Americans and African Americans forming a tribe from forming the first incorporated black town in the United States in Oklahoma. And then I'm doing an adaptation of the Odyssey called Black Odyssey in Denver.
Wow.
And co-production with Yale Rep and Berkeley Rep about the free people of color in 1836 in Louisiana. So most of my plays are, obviously, as you can tell, are history plays.
Mm-hmm.
I really am obsessed with history, and I feel like history is a powerful way to look at where we go into the future. And I really just want to put more actors on stage. I like big cast. I like poetic language, as I said before. And I really am passionate about expanding the form of theater. I think a lot of theater can be very conventional, that a lot of plays seem to be redundant in its style. And though I know often my work is very controversial for it, style is aesthetic. I really want to push against that because I think we're going to need new forms in order for to bring new audiences to the theater. And new forms help us to look at the world in new ways. So that's where my passion lies.
What you're just saying now, Marcus Gartley, is I think very critically important to the future of theater, not just the future of theater, but to the future of theater, but also to, which I think is going to be a real struggle coming up, which I think people like you are in the midst of, which is defining the new American culture of the 21st century. And I say that, I mean, I'd like to hear your thought about this, because I've been thinking about this a lot. You look at, you know, some people look at when white people in America take things that come out of black culture, whether it's a physical movement or a way of expressing yourself or a way of writing or dance, whatever it could be. And people say, oh, that's expropriation. On the other hand, and it is a little bit, on the other hand, there's something afoot in America where black culture is kind of encompassing all of America and,
right.
and changing the way it thinks and sees the world. And when I see your stuff and read your stuff and other people of your generation, that's part of the dynamic I see happening.
Absolutely. Well, I think you can get, I think any expression of the United, you know, the identity of the United States at its root is going to have some expression, some part of it is black. Because, you know, music that's created in the United States, you know, it's black. I mean, you know, a lot of it has black roots. You know, what we understand is the blues and spirituals and field hollers and
right.
what have you. All of that is rooted in black. Mm-hmm. And so it seeps into other forms of expression, of artistic expression, so there's no way to get away from it. I think, and that's beautiful. And I think also, too, I think I will herald the day where we can celebrate our diversity and also pull in other cultures as an amalgam, an identity, a diverse identity. So I think we need both a diverse identity, but also be able to celebrate what's unique about each part of who we are. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I think the conversation in the past has been black and white. I think it's been this binary of, well, that's good, that's bad, or this is black, this is white. And I think the conversation has to be, it's more gray. We realize that it's more gray than we thought, and that's a good thing. But I, you know, I'm careful to talk about not identifying as black or not calling the work black or not saying that there's a such thing as a black play, because I think blackness has to be celebrated. But I also think we have to be, when our work is evaluated, we should be, you know, judged against our look under the same lens as our white counterparts, as our Asian counterparts, as our Latina counterparts. And what seems to happen is that people say, well, you're the next August Wilson, or you're the Lorraine Hansberry or the Susan Laurie Park. And I think that's a very small conversation. So while I think I love it when our work is celebrated as being black, I think we're also part of the American quilt as well.
And I think that going back to what you were saying earlier, before we jump back into the play that's now at center stage, the plays you described that you're in the midst of writing or working on the moment, the one about the first African-American Indian tribe and what was it? What happened in 1936, was it? What you said, 1936?
1836 was Louisiana, Free People of Color.
After 1836, right. And those are kind of critical pieces of history. So I'm curious, I mean, where are you on those productions and what are you working on saying through them?
Well, the plays are finished. I'm the Native American black play that takes place in 1850. It's called The Road Weep. That play is having a national tour. So it started in Alaska, then it was produced in Minneapolis, and now it's up actually in L.A. right now. It opened last week, and then it's going to go to Florida. So it has its own kind of tour. So I'm finished with that play, and I'm just going to each of those occasions on opening night and sitting in some of the rehearsals. And then the piece and about the Free People of Color in Louisiana in 1836, that play has never been produced before. And it will open in my hometown in Berkeley, which is close to Oakland, where I'm from. It will open there and then go to New Haven at Yale Rep. And so I'm going to, you know, work on that a little bit more when I get into rehearsal with those actors.
I mean, they sound really important, and I look forward to reading those and seeing those. I'm really taken by that. So going back to this play, there's one thing I want to ask you about, the dynamic around the character of Amelia and also the son and the grandfather. I mean, I love the way, I mean, she's a very powerful character in this, Amelia. Now, do all of the way this particular production of your play was directed by Kwame, are your plays always performed where the actor plays a series of roles like this, or are they performed differently in different places?
Oh, no, they all perform the same way. You know, I did a lot of my work. I like when to see an actor pull off three or four characters. That excites me. It's intended to be done that way.
This is really kind of an amazing play, and I appreciate that Kwame brought you to Baltimore, brought it to Baltimore, and he was telling me that part of the relationship was that that you really met at the beginning of his career here.
Absolutely.
And you wanted him to direct this play.
I did. You know, I actually got the opportunity, a playwright center in Minneapolis, to ask me, well, what is your dream for this play? And I said, Baltimore Central Stage, Kwame. That was my first dream, and they made it happen. They flew him out there. We did a reading. He fell in love with the play, and it's been great ever since.
No, it has, and I appreciate it. And what play are you working on now? Where you are now? What are you working on this moment?
At this moment, I'm working on a musical, actually, which is again about history. It's about the Harlem Renaissance.
Uh huh.
And it's based on a Greek myth, but all the characters are from the Harlem Renaissance. So Billie Holiday, Cab Calloway, Duke Ellington, and Lacey Hughes are all Greek gods, and it's based on the myth of Eurydice and Orpheus.
It's really cool being inside your head for just a minute here. Because you like twisting genres.
Absolutely. I think this is a major, you know, this is a major pulse of the contemporary, I thought, you know, of fusion, you know, mashups in music. Mashups, you know, are any type of fusion, I think it's like a very contemporary. I know it. People did it in the past too, but even more so now, I would say, this fusion of ideas, this fusion of cultures, fusion of literature, stories. You know, I thought it for a long time because I thought, you know, taking European stories and adapting them, like, you know, I don't know if I want to do that. And then what I realized is that story, you know, my grandmother taught me that a story, you should take a story and add your own thread to it, give it your own identity, because they're going to live forever. And when you put your own marker to it, you give it new life. And so no one owns stories. People don't, you know, when you give them out to the world and the world or various cultures take them, story is not really theirs, it's part of their identity, but when you add your new thread to it, it has a richer, it has a certain flavor to it that makes it new again. And so I'm really excited about doing that. I like to fuse things, and I like to question what stories meant in the past and what do they mean now. I'm really excited about that kind of work.
And you're kind of, I think, to give us people a sense of this and who will be going to Center Stage to see this particular work, I mean, your work kind of has this breadth to it that covers lots of territory. You have a play like On the Levee, which is, I guess, I haven't seen it, only read about it, is really a musical about the,
that's right,
about the great worst flood in U.S. history. The people have written books about the Mississippi flood of 1927. Then you've got the world in a woman's hands. I mean, you and this kind of a cappella show of African American women. I mean, so you really kind of throw yourself into different places.
I do. I like to challenge myself. I think that's really important as an artist. I always try to raise the bar with each project. I want to do something that scares me, something that educates me, but also something that I feel like audiences need to know about, a history that has been buried, and also a story where, like, in particular, this a cappella musical, which is about African-American women joining the labor force in the Bay Area. You know, they were working in shipyards. These women were, that I interviewed to write this piece, were in their 70s, 80s, some 90s and 100s. And I wanted them to see their story on stage before they went, you know, before they left us. To me, that was a gift to them, but also for their families and also for the world to really see, you know, what was it like for these women to join the labor force in a major way and the sacrifices that they made. You know, they're heroes, they're heroines. So that piece I have really close to my heart.
And the one you described earlier, the road weeps, the well runs dry. I'm so happy the things you pick up. I mean, the things you pick up are things that I've been reading about for years, and I can't wait to see this or read this one. This, I mean, when you pick up the world of the Black Seminole, that people don't really, they don't. It's a hugely important piece of our history, which stretches from Florida to Oklahoma, and if you take it even further, takes us down to Mexico.
That's right. That's absolutely right.
Right. So I mean,
absolutely.
It's an incredible story. How did you hear that story first? Where did you find that story first?
Well, you know, it's a great I'm glad you asked that. I decided I was going to write a play about an all-black town because, you know, I'm obsessed with Toni Morrison and I wanted to follow in her footsteps in that way.
Uh-huh.
And I started doing research and I came across this article that said Wewoka, Oklahoma was the first incorporated all-black town, which means it was the first black town to have a post office. Eatonville, which is where Zora Neale Hurston is from, that's considered the first all-black town.
Right.
So I started to do research on Wewoka and I realized, oh, my grandmother's from there, my father's mother. And the more research I did about this town, I realized this is my history. I realized that I was have Seminole ancestry.
Hmm.
My father knew about that. And so there was all these connections. And the play really spilled out of that. By me doing my ancestral history, me digging into the past, really studying both the African-American people in the tribe and the Native American people tribe and how their cultures merged. Again, another fusion. How their cultures merged and what a beautiful tribe they formed by uniting together as one.
One of my favorite stories in American history, one we all need to know. I think that
absolutely,
I really do. Folks, I can't encourage you more to go see Dance of the Holy Ghosts, a play on memory. Marcus Gardley is the playwright. Kwame Kwayarma, who you heard at the very beginning of the show, artistic director of Center Stage, directed this particular production. And we'll be linking to a great deal of Marcus Garvey's other work on our website at steinershow.org. And Marcus Garvey, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
And thanks for your work.
My pleasure.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.